Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Yinka, and I'm your host. Today is our Web3 1:1 session here at the Dapplist. Today, we have Cyril with us from Swap Finance. We are having a conversation on the topic of impermanent loss and how it is an issue for DeFi mass adoption. And Cyril and the team over at Swap Finance are taking a rather interesting approach to solving this problem. And I'm pretty sure we're going to be really excited to dive into this. If you've ever, you know, played with a DeFi at any point, from, you know, farming to trying to get some yields and just navigating the entire DeFi space, this should be an interesting topic. And if you've ever, like myself, experienced impermanent loss first time or firsthand, then this should also be, you know, an interesting topic and also a breath of fresh air on how this problem is being approached and solved. So thank you once again. Cyril, if you don't mind, give us a quick intro about yourself and then we can hit the ground running.
Sure. Thanks for receiving me today. Again, I'm super glad to be talking about this issue of impermanent loss. So as for myself, I'm the co-founder of Swap Protocol. At Swap, our mission is to enable every type of investor to benefit from passive, profitable, and secure yield strategies. And in this context, we are like fighting against impermanent loss. We're creating the first AMM that strongly reduces impermanent loss. The reason why I'm talking about this topic today, I would like to discuss this topic of impermanent loss, is that I've been studying impermanent loss over the past year while building Swap. I think I've accumulated a lot of knowledge about it, and I want this knowledge to be shared so that everybody can take this into account while developing their farming strategies. So that's the reason why I wanted to discuss about this with you today.
Awesome. No, that's fantastic. I think one of the best way you can, you know, create scenarios that make sense is if you've worked with them or experienced them yourself. But before we proceed and go further into, you know, all of the in-depth details of Swap and all of that cool stuff, what exactly is impermanent loss? We could work with two definitions, like the high level and low level definition. It's completely fine, and those approach will be helpful for people who already have an idea of what impermanent loss is, and then people who have no idea what it is, you know, those definitions will be helpful. So,
all right. So maybe if we start with the really high level definition, when you want to get yield on your crypto assets, one of the possible strategies that you have is to become a liquidity provider in a protocol, in AMM protocols, automated market makers, like Uniswap, SushiSwap, Trader Joe, for instance, on Avalanche, QuickSwap on Polygon as well. When you're going to LP into those protocols, you will see some returns that are going to be advertised. The problem is that those returns don't take into account a phenomenon which is called impermanent loss, which are losses in capital that affect your LP position when you LP into volatile assets. So, for instance, ETH against USDC, for instance, and that the price of the said assets start to diverge. So, yeah, that's what impermanent loss is, actually. So, impermanent loss are losses in capital that affect liquidity providers when the prices of the assets they supply liquidity to start to decorrelate. Yeah, so that I would think that would be like the main definition for as an LP. The big issue with impermanent loss is that actually in many of the cases, it ends up eating all of your returns. So many LPs end up being negative on their LP position compared to as if they had hodled their crypto assets. It's a big issue because it's very pervasive. You don't, it's not advertised on the AMM platform, so you don't really realize that you're taking such risk when you LP, and it can actually hurt your portfolio pretty badly. So for instance, there has been a study that has been made by Bancor on the Uniswap V3 performances of the LPs. And the study demonstrated that 50% of LPs actually had been losing money when providing liquidity on Uniswap V3. So that's huge. And when you compute the total amount of, the dollar amount of losses due to impermanent loss in DeFi today, it has been estimated to approximately $2 billion. So it's huge.
Wow. Yeah. No, that is an insane number, right? As someone who has also, you know, fallen victim to impermanent loss, and I did share this yesterday. Turns out, you know, I eventually remember that I've actually fallen victim to it twice, which is pathetic now that I think about it. The very first one was in the early days of like the ETH DeFi summer, right? I lost a decent amount of ETH. I wouldn't say shit ton because, you know, I'm not an ETH whale or anything, but I did lose some ETH. Again, due to impermanent loss, because I took two tokens and then I, you know, put them in this liquidity provider to provide liquidity. And then one of the tokens just rugged and it took like the value of ETH that I had all the way down, man. It still burns. Whenever I go through like my wallet transaction history, I just like cover my face in shame because it was so pathetic. However, but yes, and so those experiences, I'm not even going to lie, they did sort of hold me back from then, again, you know, venturing into providing liquidity into any sort of DeFi, pools and whatnot. I just look at this and I'm like, well, you know, I don't know, man. This looks interesting, but I've been bitten twice and it makes sense to not bother going into this again. But, you know, again, here the Dapplist team, where we came across Swap Finance and we're talking about how your team is solving this issue. So one of the other things that is interesting is the exact words that make up impermanent loss, being impermanent loss, means that the loss to an extent is somewhat impermanent until when, or how exactly, you know, how exactly does that translate itself?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. Actually, the amount of impermanent loss you're going to suffer is going to depend from, is going to be based on the difference between the price at the time you exit your LP position and the price at which you enter your liquidity position, your LP position. So if you start to LP when ETH is at 1,000 USDC, then there's like a bull run and a bear market. ETH goes up to, I don't know, like 5,000 and then goes down to 1,000. If you exit when the ETH is at 1,000, actually, you will not face any impermanent loss.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that crypto markets don't tend to be like going back so much to their positions. I mean, it happens, of course, because there is high volatility, but those markets are trending a lot. If you take the compounded annual growth rate of Bitcoin since its creation, I think it's somewhere around like 180%, like 180% per annum or 200% per annum. Ethereum must be also very high. I don't have the figure, to be honest.
Mm.
But what I mean is that usually a token either goes to the moon or to dust, right? To
zero. Yeah.
Either one of them.
Yeah.
So, and the problem is when you are an LP in an AMM and you suffer from impermanent loss, you will suffer in both cases from impermanent loss. Whether the token goes to zero or to the moon, you will suffer badly from that.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's also interesting, right? This is assuming it is only one token that is having this growth or decline. But if both tokens are having a relatively significant or, you know, a fairly consistent growth projection, I don't think you suffer impermanent loss then, do you?
So actually it depends on the correlation of the tokens. Like if they grow together, yes, like your impermanent loss will be very limited. However, if they are like uncorrelated, then you would suffer from impermanent loss because they don't grow at the same pace or at the same with the same based on the same conditions. And actually, if the tokens are completely uncorrelated, not even uncorrelated, but like correlated negatively in the sense that when one increases, the other usually it means that the other decreases. Mm. So, for instance, one example in real life of that is like energy prices with airplane companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So airplane companies and energy prices are negatively correlated because when the price of energy increases, it means that the tickets, it means higher costs for airplanes, for airplane companies. And it means travel companies. And so basically it means that they are losing more money and they have less customers. And so...
Yeah,
so that happens in real life. So basically, if your tokens are negatively correlated, you will end up actually having even more impermanent loss because one of them is rising and the other is going down. So it's accelerating super fast, the difference in the tokens.
Yeah, 100%. But I don't also think it is. Yes, there is volatility and there are like discrepancies with how each token sort of experiences growth per minute, hour, day, season, or whatever. It's not technically unlikely with the plethora of tokens we have to experience positive growth from both ends, right?
Yeah,
I don't know if
you've
experienced. Yeah, right. Okay, cool. That would actually be the ideal situation, realizing that it doesn't really, if you have, buy two tokens and both of them are just like, if we're in a bull run, the timing is right, everything is, blissful, and both of them just have this fairly consistent projection of growth, then, you're taking profit from your LP pool, and then your tokens are also like, still in the green. So that would have been a more ideal scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly, that's hard to target. Like,
100%,
you would need release some tokens where the fundamentals are pretty close, mm-hmm. so that you ensure that like the correlation is like makes sense. Because if you have no way to explain the correlation, it means that it's just like by chance. So like
yes, 100%. It would be pure gamble at the time.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's it's something that you can do for sure. The issue maybe on that is that actually, in order for Pair to be profitable, what you need is that you need demand for trading. One needs to really understand what an AMM is. An AMM is in the business of providing liquidity to people who want to trade assets. So like you can compare, in a sense, AMMs to the cash counters at the airport. Where you want to trade your currencies, right? It's kind of the same. And what if you want to have yield in an AMM, you need to have people who want to trade, because that's where the yield comes from, like the actual real yield. So if you don't have that, it means that you are only getting arbitrage, so which is toxic volume extracting value from the pool. So what I mean is that essentially, if you are just providing liquidity on two tokens, random tokens that are correlated but don't have any, like no one trades, for instance. Usually you have a token that is used in order to do all the trading between the pairs, right? Like ETH or stablecoins or Matic on the Polygon network. But for instance, no one is using, we don't have a token yet, but no one will be using the swap token as a way to trade against all the other tokens, right? You're not going to trade a swap token with a Dapplist token if there is a token at some point. So it's actually pretty hard to find tokens that are really correlated and where there is actual demand for trading.
Mm. And then obviously liquidity to actually carry out that trade.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So that is quite interesting, and I think that is the point. So, however, how do you, when we have, so we see certain pools, one of them would be a stable coin, and then another one could be a more, a quote-unquote less volatile token, which is like Ethereum, Bitcoin, perhaps Binance, BNB, in a not-so-devastating bear market, right? So, at those times, these are prior to swap and then solving the problem of impermanent loss. There will still be some level of impermanent loss, but not significant. How exactly do those work when there is a stable coin and then there is like, a different cryptocurrency like Ethereum that is at the top four or top 10, I think.
Yeah. To be honest, I kind of disagree with you on that point. Like even for tokens like Ethereum, you have huge differences which incur like a lot of impermanent loss. And I'd like to take
keep in mind, however, pardon me, do keep in mind, like I said, not so devastating bear market. So when things aren't like chaotic, but go on though. I understand your point.
Even in a bull run, like crypto is made of cycles. And when you look, like, for instance, let's take like the previous bull run. I think during the previous, like if you take the bottom of the last bear market and the top of the bull run that we experienced in 2021, I think ETH start like the bottom of the previous bear market was like $80 for ETH, and the top was around 4,000, right?
Yeah,
something like this. Basically, what we did at Swap is that we tried to estimate how much impermanent loss you would suffer from if you start like at the bottom and end up and sell at the top and exit your liquidity position at the top. And the answer is actually you're going to suffer from 65%. of your portfolio in terms of impermanent loss. That's huge.
Right.
You're losing 65% of opportunity compared to your like what you would have kept if you had just hodled. So in order to make up for that, I think that you need actually a yield on the AMM, which is, I think it's around like 50% per annum, something like this. Like based on the time frame that was...
APY is about 50%.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. Which doesn't happen in practice.
Right? Which, yes, which technically does it. Yeah, no. Okay, well, that's interesting.
So I mean, even with ease, you know, you can like you can get burned pretty badly, actually. So
yeah, for sure. So I suppose, and again, well, I guess my fear at the time was justified, you know, not just after I've been burned twice, not ignoring the fact that, oh, there is a stable coin pair, which, quote unquote, gives the illusion of a less risky liquidity provision, and then you know less likely to fall to experience impermanent loss.
Oh, so stable coin pairs are fine though. Like stable to stable are fine. Like
not stable to stable. Again, stable to stable, the yields aren't particularly significant. It is a high risk, high reward type thing. So like you have a stable, and then you have another asset. Working with those two is where you know you are at the edge between having massive returns, quote unquote, and then well losing a decent amount of your portfolio, depending on however the market decides to swing.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the end, playing like having a liquidity position in AMM is like playing casino, you know. So when you go to the casino, your expected payoff is negative, right? However, like you have chances to make, like you have significant chances to make money. I mean, they are below like 50%, of course, but they are significant. And you have significant chances to lose it all, right? So, and the expected payoff is negative. And that's a bit the same with AMMs, liquidity positions, is that actually the variance of the returns of the strategy are huge. The payoff is on average, I mean, maybe it's a little bit over zero or... most likely it's negative. So basically, while it's great for casino to have such structure of payoff, it's super bad when you're a financial investor. Because what you're looking for as a financial investor is the lowest amount of risk given a certain amount of return. Or in another way to say that, the highest return possible given a certain amount of risk that you're willing to take.
All right.
And the philosophy behind swap, actually, is to really try to reduce the risk of the strategies, of the market-making strategies, so that you don't need to, I mean, so that you, and still have, like, consistent return, but really reduce the volatility of such strategies.
Yeah, that is cool. That's an interesting approach. And so, besides impermanent loss, that is an issue... what other issue do you think, because one of the things we're talking about is, you know, DeFi adoption at scale, as much as we can manage as an ecosystem and as we grow in this space, what do you think are the other issues that plagues mass adoption of DeFi currently?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe I'd like to come back first to exactly why impermanent loss is a huge problem for DeFi adoption. I think we've covered it in depth regarding like the liquidity provider issue, right? So as a liquidity provider, of course, like it's a real problem. And a lot of people actually don't want to LP because of impermanent loss. And I think you're a great example of that because you got burned twice and now you don't want to LP again. And I think you're making a good decision. But so less liquidity on chain means less adoption of DeFi and, you know, like no flywheel effects. Impermanent loss is also very dangerous on two other points. The first thing is that I think it's super, like when you first land into Web3, into crypto and DeFi, you're very wary and you have this kind of thing that's impermanent loss that's super hard to understand that you hear about or not, or you can get wrecked like you were. So I think it's a very bad introduction to the DeFi world to have this phenomenon of impermanent loss that's like... looming over the new users. So I think it's a problem when you're onboarded into DeFi to have such an issue and such a risk, which is hard to understand for the average user. The other element, which I think is important, is that traders on AMMs are also affected by impermanent loss. Why is that? It's because like the fees on AMMs have to be somewhat high in order to compensate, partially at least, the LPs from the losses that they have due to impermanent loss.
Yeah.
Because of that, the quotes on-chain are actually super high. And today, we see that there is only approximately 10% of the total crypto trading volume that is done on-chain. And 90% is done on the centralized exchanges.
Mm.
And the reason for that is just the quotes are not competitive. And that's partially because of impermanent loss. So yeah, that was on board the impermanent loss. On the other thing that are like hurting DeFi adoption, I think there are still many things that need to be solved. So one thing I think is like the infrastructure. I think we need more throughput and lower gas fees in order to be able to deploy much like many more transactions and like a faster settlement as well of the financial transactions on chain, and also be able to deploy more complex models that can integrate more information in order to deal to develop new financial strategies that are more complex than what we have today in DeFi. Other aspects which I think are key to solve are, I mean, all the aspects that are related to transaction costs, actually. One of them is MEV, for instance, maximum extractable value. So MEV basically are operations that can be performed on-chain in order to extract profit from a transaction by being faster than the transaction that is coming. This is actually extracting a lot of value from people who have like a normal usage, I would say, of DeFi. And I'm convinced that if we manage, like if MEV can be solved, it could really help like DeFi adoption as well in terms of technology infrastructure. Then I think another obstacle to DeFi adoption is UX and UI, especially 100%. For retail, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know if you have any experience to share on that, because I felt like you were challenging something.
I did have that as like some of the questions and the things I wanted us to discuss. I do think at this point, you know, the UX is just absolute shit. For myself, when I started into crypto, I was fairly technical savvy. So I didn't have any issue necessarily navigating the space, setting up MetaMask and all of that stuff. But every single one of my friends locally that I have spoken with, and I said, yo, you know, I think you should, you know, get in on crypto, set up your MetaMask. And they're like, what? Why? You know? And the UX is not particularly intuitive, right? These people have no problem working with Binance and stuff. But when you bring in MetaMask into the mix, you bring in Uniswap, and then, okay, perhaps even asking these people to then go ahead to provide liquidity into a pool. And they're like, why? Right? And then, you know, but my point is, I was just chuckling and affirming what you said, because it's a conversation that I do think we should have more often as people and as engineers, as developers who are building in this space and just trying to welcome or improve DeFi mass adoption. So that's all, yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And it's the same for all of my friends, like super hard to get them to download MetaMask and understand what's happening down there, right? Totally agree about that.
So then that begs the question, I suppose, is how then do we make the user experience less of more intuitive, maybe not less technical, more user friendly, right? You know, the way it is built at this point in time, it's just a lot. There are so many buttons, there's so many, and users that aren't very technical savvy are at the risk of falling into scams, right? The difference between the Uniswap exact domain with Uniswaps is just an S, and someone could miss it. And then they are into a completely different dApp that just drains the wallet, right? So there is the potential of being scammed. There is the possibility of not having an idea of what you're even working with, you know. So begs the question of how do we possibly make, you know, this financial system that we're building to be more, we could say beginner friendly, but I don't know if that is the time right now where we are at this early stage, but at least we're progressively working towards that.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's such a big topic and there are so many things that need to be done. Mm. I guess it's kind of a shared responsibility between like protocols, 100%. Wallets, front end, right? Like, but I think we're starting to see some interesting thing, like also like in other ecosystems. So for instance, like there are some new wallets that are performing, I mean, that I think are much more intuitive than MetaMask. At least, I perceive them more intuitive.
I don't necessarily agree, but that's okay. so I do think people shit on MetaMask a lot, and I don't like it. I'm a fan. I wouldn't say I'm a maxi or anything, but I'm a huge MetaMask fan, right? The Rainbow wallet is cool. I think it is more fancy than it is particularly intuitive, and I stand to be corrected here, right? I'm not sure if it is in and of itself reducing the barrier to entry. Again, everyone in the audience, pardon me, please feel free to jump in at any point in time and come at my head. It's okay, it's an amazing, we can have that conversation. If you would like to jump in at any point, please raise your hand and I will gladly bring you up. But my point is, people shit on MetaMask a lot. I think that is the case. And all of the wallets we see coming out aren't necessarily changing the game significantly. They're just a few tweaks in the UI, a lot of emojis, and just fancy stuff, right? So it's quite interesting, that dynamic and how we are approaching it. But like you said, it is a collective responsibility, and every single one of us should consistently try to improve, and just like refine things and finesse things as time goes on.
Yeah, also I think it's like there is a question around like, should DeFi be accessible to everybody, and should everybody will everybody in the future have access to will everybody like manage their own like investments and try to understand like what are the risk, financial risk of each strategy of market making or whatever? I'm not so sure.
No, that is a really good question, right? One of the things that came to my mind while we're having this conversation would be, is it the case that we need to reduce the barrier to entry, or the case that just more people need to be educated, right? Whoever is enthusiastic enough should just we provide as many tools as we can to educate people, whereas it is easier to get educated than it is easier to scale downwards and like dumb down these processes. Which brings your question and this conversation as to, is everyone supposed to have access to DeFi? I would say it would be nice that everyone can, if I am so interested and inclined to be curious enough, yes, I would say that should be the case. Are we building that for everyone? I don't think that is true. I don't think we can do that, right? For as many people that will be interested enough and curious enough to want to figure it out, I propose that we significantly reduce the barrier to entry and make it less of a hassle for people to figure this out.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. What I also think is key, if we want more DeFi adoption, is lifting the barriers for institutional players to come in. And so that's because, in traditional finance, when you compare, it's always interesting to compare with StratFi just to see if the goal of DeFi is to overtake TradFi, we're going to need to provide solutions for all the actors of the current financial system. And today, the biggest actors obviously are institutional investors. I think we can have much better institutional finance in DeFi that is with much less fees and that's distributed much more of the profits to all the people. But nevertheless, if we want really DeFi to scale, we're going to need institutional, a good environment for institutional investors as well. So I think this is also a topic that needs to be tackled
100%.
By some projects.
100%. I do agree with that. Before we proceed, hi, everyone. Welcome to the DAPLIS. Welcome to our Web3 1:1 session. Today we have with us Cyril from Swap Finance. We're talking about impermanent loss, how it is an issue for DeFi adoption, but more so, Swap Finance team are actively solving that problem. So if you are, curious, if you've ever experienced impermanent loss, if it is something that has actually hit you, like myself, we can follow the Swap Finance team and just engage in this conversation. If you have questions as to how exactly they're solving this problem, I'm sure Cyril will be more than happy to respond to that. Now, you know, back to the conversation real quick. One of the things we talked about, you know, yesterday on our Discord is how Ethereum might not necessarily play a huge role in the scalability and mass adoption of DeFi, mostly because of its ridiculous fees, you know, rightly so, at this point in time, and how fast it executes transaction and stuff. So what role do you see other chains playing in the mass adoption of DeFi as we progress?
Yeah, so what I meant is that I think Ethereum is going to be like the settlement layer. So it's going to be more like the backbone of this chip. So it's going to play a major role, but not like, it's not going to be like the chain the users are going to integrate to interact with. So, I mean, I think, honestly, I cannot predict the future, and I'm not an expert in infrastructure, so
yeah.
I won't be able to say, okay, like this chain is probably going to nail it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more like a user, right? As a protocol, like we want chains that have better throughputs with lower transaction fees that guarantee the best security to our users so that their funds are safe and that is like also decentralized. So I think today, like the current narrative is around like the layer twos, of course. So it seems like the future of DeFi is probably going to happen mostly on layer twos, so like the optimistic rollups, and today and tomorrow, like the ZK rollups, the zero knowledge rollups, which seem to be able to deliver even better like fees and throughput. However, honestly, I don't know. Maybe like some other chain is going to come and it's just going to kill the game, right? So I'm not the best person to answer that question, I think.
No, yeah, I mean that's completely okay, and I do think it's an open conversation. I'm curious to hear what Chief Maiwa has to say. Maiwa, you know, that's an interesting question. I'm wondering if you have thoughts and opinions on it, if you don't mind.
Okay. Sorry, I think I missed the question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll just go over it again. So Cyril and I had a conversation yesterday over on the Dapplist Discord where we were sort of talking about how one of the issues, again, plaguing DeFi and mass adoption as it pertains to retail investors with Ethereum's fees and stuff, because swap finance is built on Polygon, inexpensive and fast. So the question is, what role do we see Ethereum, if any, playing in like the mass adoption of DeFi? And where exactly do we see mass adoption of DeFi coming from necessarily? Again, this is fairly speculative. So, you know, nothing is set in stone. And we can just like, you know, play with these ideas.
Okay, yeah. Okay. It's been a great conversation. I've been working and listening at the same time. And I'm a huge, you know, admirer of swap finance. For various reasons. And I have a question at the end of my answer. So, but just to answer your question, I think Ethereum will play more of a security layer for a lot of layer two blockchains. So a lot of them are going to be doing the processing, you know, on their own chain, and then you know they'll be settling all of those things on Ethereum. And it's really going to boost the adoption of DeFi in the sense that there will be more, maybe higher transaction throughput. So the thing is, when it comes to retail DeFi and institutional DeFi, while retail DeFi is still trying to like catch up, institutional DeFi is really growing. I mean, that is exactly why the YDX left, you know, has, you know, left to have their own app chain, right? The reason is they're trying to, the YDX is trying to respond to the demands of their own users, right? Their institutions using them. They want to trade more transactions per second, right? And their users are not too excited by the, you know, by the amount of transactions that are processed on the, you know, Ethereum block. So they decided to move to, you know, Starkware and, you know, deploy their stuff and have their own app chain and all those things. And I think that's where eventually most of, you know, a lot of protocols will go to, right? Because the world needs faster transactions. Everybody's already used to, you know, Visa kind of transactions, and we need to replicate the same. Yeah, so I think Ethereum will play a huge role in providing, you know, security for a lot of the layer two blockchains. I think that's what is gonna happen. But I see, you know, I personally see more adoption in the layer two space in the future. Yeah, I do see that.
Awesome, cool. Thank you very much for that. So, from that, just real quick, what is like your top three layer twos that you're bullish on and that you're like looking at, you think mass adoption or, you know, this is going to happen on?
Yeah, I think first one is going to be Polygon, obviously. They've got a lot going on, right? So they're working on different verticals, right? So different verticals of layer two products, both ZK proofs, etc. So they're doing, you know, all of that stuff. I think next one will be Near Blockchain, especially because they have both the Aurora, which is like the EVM blockchain, and then the Near Blockchain itself. I think you know, adoption in that area is going to grow well. I also think I'll say maybe Stackware. Yeah, I'll say maybe Stackware is also going to do very well as well. I think those are my top three for now. Those are my top three for now.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much, Maya. Awesome. Thank you for that. Cyril, so back to you, if you don't mind answering that question.
Sorry, I have a question. Okay, sure. Ask Cyril. Yeah, that was why I requested to speak, yes.
Okay, yeah, sure.
So Cyril, I understand that Swap is a matrix market maker, right? Which has an entirely different operation from, you know, the product market maker that Uniswap is, and, you know, the rest that Balancer and Curve are. What I want to understand is how Swap's design as Swap's matrix market maker design, how it helps to solve the impermanent loss problem that exists in DeFi. I think that is the part I don't understand fully yet. So if you could explain, I would appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you very much for your question. So yeah, that's a very interesting question. So there are first let's start with the type of value that we deliver with the matrix market maker, and then I will deep dive into the design. So basically, the matrix market maker has like three main features. The first one is that it strongly reduces impermanent loss. So it increases profits for LPs while reducing the risk. We also enable like multi-asset pools with such design. So multi-asset pools, it means that you can provide up to 8 assets in our pools, which means that with our protocol, you can actually create index-like products that net you fees instead of costing you fees, essentially. The last thing that we do also is that we are able to deliver cheaper fees to traders by actually reducing the share that is taken by arbitragers. So, for instance, right now we have one pool that is live on Polygon with approximately a bit less than 600K of liquidity. Right now we are one of the two best places to trade below $200 along with Uniswap V3, for instance. So now if we go into the design, like what's different between the MMM and the AMM model? The first thing that we do differently is that we really try to tackle the root cause of impermanent loss. And the root cause of impermanent loss is actually the rebalancing that is made on traditional AMMs and that follows like the prices, essentially. So what I mean by that is that in a traditional AMM, suppose you LP when ETH is worth 1,000 USDC and you LP in a pool with one ETH and 1,000 USDC. If the price of ETH increases, you're going to lower your exposure to ETH. If the price of ETH decreases, you are going to increase your exposure to ETH, and you are going to decrease your exposure to USDC. So in each case, what a traditional AMM does is that they are shorting the good asset, the asset that is trending in that is trending up, and they are long the bad asset, the asset that is going downwards. What we try to do at Swap is to maintain your initial inventory no matter the price variation. So it's like as if you were hodling your assets into your ledger, except that we are using them to do market making and to get fees on the side. So if I take my example again of one ETH and 1,000 USDC, if you are in a traditional AMM and the price of ETH goes up to 2,000 USDC, you will be rebalanced to 0.7 ETH and 1,400 USDC. So you will have a total portfolio of 2,800 USDC. At Swap, you will still have one ETH, worth 2,000 USDC and 1,000 USDC. So you will have a total portfolio of 3,000 USDC. So then the question is like, how can you allow people to trade, and how can you update the prices when the quantities kind of try to stay the same, like, or optimize to stay the same? Because when someone trades, basically they create an imbalance in a pool. Because, for instance, if you go into my pool that has one ETH and 1,000 USDC, and you buy like 0.1 ETH, I'm going to end up with 0.9 ETH and 1,100 USDC, for instance. So it's going to be like, there's going to be a discrepancy. The other problem is that in traditional AMMs, what drives the price, the prices, are the quantities of assets within the pool. The prices are computed by just dividing the quantities of assets. So we need another mechanism to find the price. So what we use is we use oracles that are provided by Chainlink in order to update the prices within our pool. The oracles are also very useful because in a traditional AMM, what happens is that actually the arbitragers are updating the prices within the pools. So with our design, we're able to rely on oracles. And so we basically, arbitragers, they always extract value from the LPs because they always pocket a profit when they are doing a trade. And that money has to come from somewhere, and that somewhere are the LPs. So by using oracles, we actually protect LPs from arbitragers and we increase like the value for the LPs. The issue is that oracles come with another issue, which is called front running. So front running, or I mean, it's a kind of MEV where basically you anticipate the movement in the price oracle and you have a transaction that is deployed before the oracle updates so that you can profit from it. In order to counter this, what we do is that we have fees that are dynamic and that are based on the market conditions. Basically, if there is a significant difference between two oracle feeds, you will face like more front running, because there is a higher like opportunity to arbitrage, to do some arbitrage. So what we are doing is that we try to anticipate how much the deviation is going to be. So we try to price the risk that the oracle price is going to change much. And whenever there is a high risk, we increase the fees so that it's not very profitable for someone to front run the oracles. On the other hand, when the risk is low, we can provide like very low fees because it's not a problem for the liquidity providers. The last thing that we do, and that's more like the rebalancing aspect. So we entice, we try to align the behavior of the trader with the desired outcome for the LPs. So basically, a trade on swap has to perform has to either bring revenues to the LP, or it has to reduce the risk faced by LPs. So when we have a pool that is balanced, so again, let's take the example of one ETH and 1,000 USDC. If a trader comes, he's going to create an imbalance in the pool, which is not good. So because the trader creates an imbalance, that person is going to undergo some slippage. So we'll have to pay a higher price for the assets. On the other hand, once the pool is imbalanced, we are basically providing incentives to traders to rebalance the pools thanks to a slippage that this time is in favor of the trader. So if I take a very concrete example, if a trader comes and trades 0.1 ETH on my pool, maybe we're going to make him pay not 100 USDC, which would be the actual price, but 101 USDC, let's say. So once this has been done, the pool now has 0.9 ETH and 1,101 USDC. But the pool is balanced. So another trader is going to come and is going to be able to sell to the pool 0.1 ETH, but get 101 USDC. So this trader is going to pocket kind of $1, for instance. I mean, those are illustrative figures, of course. And so that's how we ensure that the pool is always balanced and the risk of the LPs is managed, essentially. So I hope I could answer your question and it was not too complicated.
No, that wasn't. That was a really comprehensive answer. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your question.
Awesome. Thank you, Myra, for that question. Thank you, Sarah, for that very comprehensive response. You know, it quite literally, you know, answered the next question I was going to pose, which was how exactly does swap work? And well, there we have it, folks. So thank you for that. And again, everyone, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. This is our Web3 1:1 session where we bring in amazing builders in crypto and they come in and they talk about the really cool stuff they're building. Today we have with us Cyril from Swap Finance. Swap Finance is a team of amazing individuals, amazing developers solving the problem of impermanent loss. And if you've been here for the past 5-10 minutes, you just heard Cyril go over how and why that is possible, because by default, impermanent loss is something you cannot escape from whenever you provide liquidity into an AMM. But Swap Finance is changing the game. And I am particularly excited because I've had experiences that, we'll just keep that at the other side for now. But yeah, no, it's really cool to see that problem that plagues DeFi is being solved by the Swap Finance team. So amazing work, guys. So Cyril, you know, we're rounding up and just, you know, drawing the curtain. It's been an amazing session so far. What should we be expecting from the Swap team in the next couple of weeks and months? What are you doing that, you know, just share some alpha for the Dapplis community here.
Yeah, of course. I'd be happy to share some alpha with you. So basically right now, the Swap team is focused on proving that our model works. And in order to do that, we are integrating with all the aggregators, routers in the space that there are, like on the Polygon network, so that we can have actual demand, trading demand coming to feed our yields. The other priority that we have is to improve our user experience and our products, following the feedbacks of our amazing community. Mm. So that's really something that we are working on at the moment. So for instance, this week actually we shipped a new feature which enables a very seamless one asset join when you want to deposit liquidity in the pools by leveraging the rates of the aggregators, which means that you have a very fluent deposit experience. The other aspects on which we are working hard at the moment is we want to, I mean, we are also working in terms of research. So the product that we have developed now, Swap V1, is just a first step, and we have identified some elements where we can like improve the product. So basically, we are focusing in the coming months on building the new version of our algorithms with two directions in mind. The first one is to improve the current algorithms of Swap V1, and the second one is to develop other strategies that have different risk profiles. Because the current strategy that we have deployed is a strategy which basically is focused at reducing as much as possible arbitrage. So it's a strategy that is actually quite conservative in terms of capital preservation and risk management. So in finance, usually, when you try to be very conservative on the risk, it means that you have a bit less opportunities. And so the yield is not like maybe lower than a strategy which has higher risk. So we are like working on developing new strategies that have higher risk. So for people that are a bit more degen and higher like expected returns.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you very much for that. So also are we seeing more tokens being added into this? So we currently have Wrapped Bitcoin, USDC, and Wrapped Ethereum. You know, I also wanted to ask, we have these three tokens. Does it make it more easier to handle impermanent loss as opposed to having other tokens? Maybe perhaps, of the other tokens that aren't these ones that are high in their market cap and they're fairly stable. So is this like a conservative approach to handle impermanent? Okay, cool.
Yeah, actually, it's easier I mean, at least with the current design that we have, our models work best on large cap tokens like ETH, BTC, etc. We're going to add more tokens, of course. But I mean, we will never be like a DEX that lists the new shitcoin, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I think the amount of tokens that will be available on the Swap platform will never be like, I mean, we'll never like have thousands of coins listed, right? It's going to be a quite conservative approach.
Mm-hmm.
However, yes, we're thinking about like opening new pools. We first want to show the world that our model is working,
mm-hmm.
and we'll gradually open to more pools. Also, what we need is that tokens where there is actual demand, like real trading demand. Because one of the tricky things in DeFi and with traditional AMMs is that there is like often some there will always be volume on the pool when you open a pool and put liquidity into it. Yeah. Because arbitrageurs are going to come in. I mean, the price are going to vary and arbitrageurs are going to come in and profit from that. However, like if it's just arbitrage trading, you cannot do profitable market making based on that.
Yeah.
So like we want to list only pairs that have actual like trading demand from people that actually want to swap their assets and not people who want to make profit on a trade, like, you know, like profit in the sense of arbitrage profits.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Makes sense. So Swap Finance is essentially focusing on like the core tokens and more so, again, like you just said, you aren't trying to be like a Uniswap that has like a shit ton of tokens, pun intended, but focusing on people who are actually there for to provide liquidity, make profits, but also have their tokens hedged from impermanent loss.
Yeah, actually, you know, like the market is mostly around big tokens. On Polygon Network, for instance, more than 50% of the trading volume is BTC, ETH, MATIC against stables or against each other. So, right. I mean, once you tackle the big tokens, like you have most of the market already. So we don't see if it fit to go further down the line. We'd rather focus on delivering great algorithms for big tokens.
For the big tokens. All right, sounds good. Sounds like a plan. All right, perfect. So this is one question I have for you, Cyril, and I throw it open as well to everyone who is interested in responding to it. I think it's an interesting question, and I would love to hear your thoughts. So my question goes thus. What are some of the controversial ideas you've been thinking about as far as DeFi is concerned, and maybe crypto as a whole, from NFTs to play-to-earn games, everything, the entire spectrum that you consider to be very, very controversial? Let's hear it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think we discussed already a bit my controversial views in a sense. So I believe that DeFi is going to be like we need a huge spike in the infrastructure in order to replace TradFi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will not be on the, like, I think Ethereum is not going to be used actually by users to do so. And it's more going to be like a settlement layer to do like all the security of the transactions. I also think that regulation is going to be key. And I know that I think that's a very controversial statement.
Yes.
I'm not saying that all regulation is good. I think a lot of it's going to be very important for the space to be able to make ourselves like understood to the regulator so that the regulation is sound. But I believe that if we want like DeFi adoption, we're going to need regulation because institutional investors are not going to come in if the regulatory environment is not stable. And maybe like we will have like two kinds of DeFi. We'll have like the unregulated one and the regulated one. But I think it's going to be important for the space to have that.
Surprisingly, I don't think I disagree. But that would be an interesting approach because again, lack of regulation has brought us to a place where people can run away with billions and billions of dollars and there are no consequences. But then again, regulation puts in some form of a restriction to development, creativity, and mass adoption. So I guess it's a double-edged sword. It would be interesting to see how the space evolves in the next 5-10 years. So yes, thank you for that, Cyril.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Maybe also like that's why like having like two spaces, you know, one that is regulated and one which is more like that remains this creativity sandbox can be the answer to that, like so that we can have more like tests and iterations.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So Maya, do you have one controversial idea that you've been, you know, wrestling with for the past couple of weeks or months that you want to share with us?
No, I actually don't have any controversial ideas for now.
That's okay. That's cool. That's cool. That's cool. I do think what Cyril mentioned about regulation is a very interesting way to look at crypto, because it sort of goes away, deviates from the entire ethos of crypto. But you know, that's one of those things.
I don't like to disagree with people running businesses, because I do believe that I believe they have something they've seen that makes them, you know, say something. So I'll say, you know, some regulation is not bad, but I don't know. But I mean, it just depends. It depends on how it goes. Yeah.
How it goes, yeah. And I suppose we'll all be here to see what plays out, right? I mean, that's the beauty of the space. We'll all be here to see how it entirely turns out and how we all evolve and maneuver this. So yeah, that is why I think this is pretty cool.
Yeah, sure.
All right, awesome. Thank you, every single one of you who joined us for this week. Thank you, Myra, for coming up to speak. Thank you, Cyril, for taking your time out to answer all of these questions. It's been an amazing time here at the DappList, and just going over, you know, DeFi and talking about Swap and talking about impermanent loss, talking about the future of crypto. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the whole week with you guys. It was great. Thanks for all of these sessions.
Great. We really enjoyed working with you as well. So again, if you want to learn more about Swap, please, there is a card right above my head by the DappList team, a tweet that we put out. We have like a lot of the info about Swap. You can also follow them on Twitter at Swap Finance. So that's SWAAP and Finance. And, you know, you can also reach out to Cyril if you have any inquiries, you're curious about anything. And you can follow the DappList team. We always come here every single week and bring in really, really amazing projects, just like the Swap team. And we talk about really cool stuff from NFTs to DeFi to DAOs and just, you know, going deep down into the people that are building stuff in this space. So thank you, everyone, for joining in. It's been an amazing session. My name is Yinka, your host, and I look forward to seeing you again very, very soon. Take care and have a good day.